This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 3rd of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're asking, what does an editor do? Does it sound obvious? I think it's a good one. You think you know what an editor does, but today we're going to take you on a little journey through a number of different landscapes that have all been edited. We'll start with books and speak to an editor who makes the difference between literary works and hard work. We'll segue into magazines and speak to Monocle's very own Andrew Tuck and one of its key voices, Andrew Muller, on how that relationship works. And we'll be in New York to figure out how a film editor works his magic on celluloid, how to choose what ends up on the cutting room floor.
The director in the editing room is looking for an ally. He's looking for someone that will push back on certain things if you feel strongly enough about them, but really will help get their vision across.
So that's What Does an Editor Do right here for the next half hour on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We're going to kick off this editorial extravaganza. Is it one? We'll see. By dealing with the novel, it's easy to imagine that books simply are, that they're an unsullied and untouched missive from the heart of the author's soul, or just a good yarn. But of course, manuscripts are edited, and a man who has seen a few is Walter Donohue, a senior editor at Faber & Faber. Walter is a man whose red pen is more respected than most.
I think a very good example of what you want me to talk about is what happened with Harper Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So she wrote this novel, sent it off to a publisher, and the editor then had her come in and talk to her about it and said it actually didn't work. But there was something in it that actually did give the editor a glimpse of there's a very kind of distinctive talent here. And he said to her, the scenes that are the flashbacks of the main character's childhood when she was a young girl and her father defended a black man in a rape case, that's very, very interesting. That's where I became engaged in the book. And he told her to go off and reconceive the novel in the light of the childhood scenes. And I think that's kind of the example between a good editor and a bad editor, because a bad editor would actually say, it doesn't work. Sorry about that.
You know, it doesn't work and I can't see why, but I can tell you that it doesn't.
Yeah, and we don't really want to publish it. Whereas a good editor will say, it doesn't work, but there is something here that is very distinctive, and it's only little flashes, but the flashes are here in these flashbacks. And if you take this and work the book through that, those scenes, then there'll be something very unique as well. So the thing is also, that's what an editor can do. I mean, it's then up to the writer to decide, well, I don't agree with you. I think this is the book I want to write. This is why I want to be published. I'll go somewhere else. Or in that case, she took him, you know, she's obviously a very modest kind of young woman. And the best writers are modest, because an editor is basically the writer's first reader. And they want the book to be read by a lot of people. And so if their first reader says, it doesn't work, you want to know, well, okay, well, does any of it work? Yes, some of it works. Well, then what should we do about making all of it work?
I should imagine in your career also it's become an intimate relationship and a great friendship, professional friendship and an actual friendship. It's a tough thing, presumably, to tread that line. Is that the thing, to have to tell someone that you've gone out and had nice lunches with and been to their house and you know their family, for example, that, you know, that four novels in or something, that some quite big part of a plot or a character doesn't work? How does that work between friends?
Well, if you are a very good friend with someone, you're very honest with them.
Right.
Because they know. I mean, whenever I've told a writer something, they've never been surprised.
Really?
Yeah. They've always sensed that they hadn't got it right, but they were just hoping that maybe it did work. The thing that you shouldn't do is tell them what to do to make it work, because what you're doing is you're imposing on the writer what you would do with a book. You have to say, this is what the problem is. This is where it's not clear. Then it's up to them to find a way.
So there's a bit of the psychoanalyst in the editor, really. You have to be a good listener, but you can't really tell people what they should go out and do. Are there any parallels between that, where you kind of, you're easing things along as a useful sounding board, but do you endanger the project when you become overly creative yourself? Do you have to ration that part of yourself back?
Yeah, exactly. It's like a director working with an actor, whether it's in the theater or on film, and somehow what they're doing doesn't work. the last thing you would do was give a line reading, say it like this, because then immediately the actor freezes up. You have to find a way of saying something to them which releases whatever it is inside them that you feel is necessary. And sometimes actors will say the best directors are the ones who just say just something very simple to them that stimulates their imagination. And that's what you do as an editor. You just say something very simple. It's a kind of a nurturing process as well.
You're mentioning there two worlds in which you used to work, theatre and film and television, I think. How much do those lead into and pay off in being a literary editor and being an editor at a literary publisher? Does it sort of help you with a script, make it filmic? I mean, filmic in the sense that it's in someone's head.
Well, I think it's a lot of what they have in common is narrative. You know, so that obviously they're different mediums, and film and writing fiction are very similar in a sense, more closer together than the theater, which is basically constructed out of, you know, it makes its impact through words. But plays also have to have narratives. And I think that's the thing that you kind of keep your kind of eye line on, is that each, whether it's a play or a film or a novel, it's got to have a narrative structure, spine going through it. And you just try to find what the structure is, even that Edward Albee play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which is two couples having...
Which is wonderful. Yeah.
You know, it's just they come in, they drink, and they the guests leave. You know, so it's very simple, a narrative.
When you get a manuscript, for example, from a first-time novelist, how long does it take you to be very clear that you like something, that you feel that something has legs?
Well, I think you owe it to the writer to be as open as possible as you start reading something. And sometimes the effect is immediate. The voice comes out and you say, oh, I'm really going to enjoy this. Other times it isn't. It's not until like in the middle of it, you know, suddenly you say, oh, now I see what this writer is doing. I think you owe it to, I mean, it's kind of hard because it takes a lot of time, that you actually have to read something from the beginning to the end, because only when you get to the end do you see what the writer is trying to do. And I think that's what, in creative writing courses, that's what they actually say to people who want to be writers, that, you know, don't spend time over getting every page perfect. Just make your way, you know, as quickly as you can to the end so the writers themselves can see what it is they're trying to say and how they resolve that. And I think as an editor, you put yourself in the same boot. Give them, say, what is it they're trying to do? Try to understand what they're doing and then say, okay, yes, this is very interesting. And it may be that it just doesn't work at all. What you can see what they're trying to do, but they're far short of it.
I wonder this. Clearly, novelists have their voices, is what makes them who they are. What about editors? Can you see in other editors' work? Can you smell it a mile off in a manuscript that you perhaps haven't taken up yourself and it gets published by someone that isn't Faber and Faber and you go, oh, yeah, old matey, I knew he'd do that. I can see his paw prints all over there. Is that true for editors as well?
Well, I think the thing is that in the end, what you really have is just taste. I mean, you may have experience doing the job, but your taste is what kind of determines, in a sense, quite often what you decide to do. You know, and there are some editors at Faber who just kind of love books which are, you know, which we call voice books, you know, where it's just basically like Vernon God Little. There's a voice that speaks, jumps out at you at the first lines of the book and grabs hold of you and all that. And on the other hand, so you're really in their subconscious through the whole book. There are other books which are kind of more narrative-driven. So there's a great story. The characters are there and well-written, but it's the story that grabs you. And quite often with the voice books, the voice is great, but there isn't a narrative. Sometimes with the narrative books, it's just this plotting is fine, but the prose is a bit flat. So there's all sorts of variations. So there are people, even within, you know, the company, who kind of prefer voice books rather than narrative books. But I think what you have to do as an editor is say, I prefer one side, but this one really, in those terms, and like as a voice book, like Vernon God Little really pulls it off and it's very good, exciting, you know, so then you'd say you'd want to do it.
Finally, Walter, I wonder if there's something that people always, first-time novelists or even experienced ones, get wrong, you know, or if there's a point at the book where you might be able to second-guess the fact that, you know, you can hear the gears grinding a little bit and need some oil sprayed in the engine, or whether it's just a change of register or a change of the person in which the book is read.
Well, I think the best thing to say to a writer, well, there's two things, one of which is just keep on going to the end. Even if you're having problems, just push yourself through that. You know, try to write as often as you can and push it all the way through to the end, because then when you see it as a whole, you get a sense of what you're trying to do. And don't spend a week just on one page getting all the language right. Leave it rough and let it go so you can actually see what it is, you know, because you only discover the end through what the characters are doing, and the characters are eventually telling you where they want to go. The other thing is that all these kind of institutions like publishing houses, film studios, television companies and all that, theaters, would be empty if there weren't storytellers. And so it's very difficult kind of sometimes getting having your voice heard, but writers have to be confident that there are stories inside them that they want to tell, and they have to have the confidence to say, okay, I'm going to tell it.
Well, I'm illuminated, as our listeners will be as well. I'm Walter Donoghue. thank you very much for your time. We're sticking with print now to find out what does a magazine editor do, and who better to ask than Monocle's very own editor, Andrew Tuck. He's been at the helm of the magazine since we launched it in 2007 and has steadily steered us as we've launched books, films, and this here radio station. So how do you keep an eye on all the factors of a multimedia brand like Monocle whilst maintaining quality and style? Over the years, one of Andrew's star writers has been Andrew Muller, who's been edited but usually knows why. It's Andrew versus Andrew on this All Andrew section of The Culture Show.
Before here, I was with a newspaper here in the UK, The Independent, and I edited variously their Saturday magazine, their Sunday magazine, and then I became an executive features editor on the Sunday paper, which means looking after all the features which aren't hard news. Before that, I was at Time Out magazine, and I was an editor there. I was a features editor, and I also kind of did their consumer pages before that. So I guess, like most people who enter the world of editing, I began as a journalist, but kind of slowly crossed over to a different side of the business.
It is a strange aspect of being an editor. I think most people sort of fall into it, which is certainly how I ended up editing at the various points where I've done that. Did you find that you enjoyed it more than being a journalist?
I think there comes a recognition when you're an editor that you have a good idea. You see something you feel should be reported. You know there's a story to tell, and you know you're not the person to do it. And that's a kind of confident moment, actually. You think, actually, I know who would be good at doing this. I know the writer to send on this story. And then you begin to get a passion for pulling together all of the elements. You know, so it's great when you see the right photographer and the right journalist go off on a mission. And whether that's, you know, reviewing a restaurant or whether that's a piece of war reporting, and they come back and they tell a tale, and they tell it in a way that you realise, actually, that wasn't your gig. You know, sure, you occasionally send yourself off and you find the spots where, you know, you've got the right voice. When you produce a magazine, you want this, you know, tightly knit, but you want a chorus of voices, and knowing that yours isn't always the one to be the solo star.
That's quite an unusually humble approach, though, and speaking as a freelance journalist who's dealt with many, many editors, I know that that's not actually all that common. Do you think there is something necessarily adversarial about the relationship between writers and editors? There are some editors I've met who do seem to regard it as a wrestling match of sorts. There's some writers who look at it that way as well. Do you think there needs to be any amount of contest in it, or is it a purely collaborative process?
It's not purely collaborative, because, you know, you're the guardian of something as well. As the editor, you're the guardian of the things that your magazine believes in, its passions, its ambitions, its hopes. And you can't devolve that to a writer. So that's when you come up with someone face to face, is when they deliver a story which, you know, you've carefully briefed them, you've given them a remit, you've explained to them your need from this story and why you're doing it, and they come back with something completely different. Now, fair enough that maybe the story didn't work out, or maybe they have a different perspective to you. But if it doesn't fit into your world, that's when you say, oh, hold on, this isn't what we asked for. But more importantly, have you answered the key questions here? And that's when the rub happens. You know, so of course there are pieces which never make it into the magazine. There are pieces which just don't work out. Sometimes the fault doesn't lie anywhere. But of course, there's a bit of push and shove. And the editor's job is to get a piece in, and, you know, the writer thinks they've done everything. And you'd say, okay, this is a good first stab, but actually these things are missing. It's to be a conscience. It's to send you back to the drawing board every now and then.
This is probably going to strike you almost instantly as a silly question, but what does an average day editing Monocle consist of?
Well, there is, oddly, at Monocle, not much of an average day, but I think that's changing for all editors. You know, so we're a business, so we have lots of, you know, commercial considerations, which I touch on here and there. We have the 24-hour radio station, which I'm speaking to you on. We do book publishing. We have events. We do conferences. And all of those things have, you know, a dreadful word, they have content. And anything that's editorial content, I would hope that my imprint, my fingerprint came on it lightly in many instances, but that I got to touch those things as a course through Monocle. So some days it is booking, you know, speakers to be at the Monocle conference. Another day it's editing a book here that we're sending off to publication. But on the magazine side and on that tight side of journalism, it's a lot of conversations with the editors here who are proficient and skilled, but kind of getting what their ideas are for their sections, but then knowing what everybody else is doing and, you know, pulling out themes, making sure that we're all heading in the same direction. And a lot of it is bullying. A lot of it is kind of saying, a lot of it is saying, hold on, you know, there's a deadline and there's a reason for this deadline. You're behind. What are you doing? There's a marshalling of the forces because, you know, as you probably know, Andrew, any good writer left to their own devices will always want an extra day, and I'm there to take that away from them.
We always want the extra day, an extra 500 words, etc., etc. Is it possible to see how the job of being a newspaper or magazine editor has changed in the time you've done it? You have been doing it a long time. You've been editing my work for at least 15 years, if my memory serves, across at least three different titles. How different is the job now to what it was, say, 15, 20 years ago?
Well, I think when I first started out, I'm talking at a time when I worked at The Independent, which is, you forget this, not that long ago. I was at The Independent when there was a big hurrah went up because my first email had arrived. And you know, we were used to copy coming in through copy takers. People would phone up the copy takers at a place in Scotland. They would dictate copy over the phone, or, you know, I would be opening the post in the morning, getting people's features. And I think then the technical skill of it was a little bit more to the fore. So if you didn't know subbing marks, if you couldn't proof properly, if you couldn't have a long phone conversation with somebody about reshaping their piece, the mechanics of it were a little bit more visible. I don't think that the heart of it has changed that much now. But with email, it's a faster process. But there is a problem, I think, that for some writers, they now see this as, you know, they send you, here's my first draft. And that element I was talking to you about, that's fine sometimes. But sometimes I think, especially these days, people think, oh, there's going to be so much to and fro in the email, it'll be fine, we'll sort it out later. And I don't like that. I like somebody to think, even if it doesn't work out like that, that when they file you something, their belief is, this is the piece. I'm going to upset them probably later on in the day. But for the moment they press send, that should be the thought in their mind.
I mean, certainly I always press send thinking that is in every way unimpeachable and perfect, and not a semicolon on its head needs altering. I'm also aware that that's fairly rarely the case, but that's kind of disappearing. There's a lot of cutbacks have been made in newspapers especially, not just on editors, but on sub-editors as well. How dangerous or, I guess, worrisome do you think that is?
Again, here's the strange thing about the very good editor, and I'm not saying that I'm in this class, but when I see great editors I've worked with, they have a skill to go from the micro, so they are worrying where that comma sits, you know, should that be a semicolon? But they can also pull out the big scale. They can see the grand sweep of a story. They can see what it looks like on page. They're ambitious about how you use fonts and type and all those elements. So it's a synthesis of all those things in the end, when you see a story on page that makes you feel proud. And there's still a bit of magic, you know, that if you get all of those things going in the right orbit, when you crack open a magazine, even for me with Monocle, sometimes you crack open the magazine and you see the story actually on paper, then finally you think, okay, this is kind of amazing. I'm proud. And I think everybody, yeah. So journalism always has been and always will be. There is a collaborative element, unless you're dealing with, you know, the one-off star writer who's, you know, if you move a comma, they'll come around and kind of slap you around the face.
That was Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, speaking to Andrew Muller. After the break, we'll find out what a film editor does. Stay tuned.
Travel in comfort with the help of the Monocle shop. It's the place to select the best bags, passport wallets, travel guides, and, of course, the latest issue of the magazine to entertain you on your lounger. We have a great lineup of special collaboration bags with Porter in Japan, including the new Overnighter bag, ideal for a city weekend trip. And then there's the limited edition Remova multi-wheel, made from lightweight polycarbonate in a special Monocle edition. Visit our stores in London, New York, Toronto, Singapore, Tokyo, and Hong Kong. Or shop online at monocle.com. Be the one turning heads at the luggage carousel.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bann. Today we're asking, what does an editor do? We're moving away from print now and heading into film. While a book or a magazine editor's job tends to be near the top of the publishing hierarchy, the film editor's place is a little more complicated. There's the producer and the director to answer to, not to mention the studio, and your collective vision might not all be focused on the same spot. So how does the creative collaboration work, and how much of a stamp can a film editor put on his or her work? Megan Billings speaks to New York-based editor Pete Boudreau.
I look at film editing as being a translator. I translate what is in the script into something that is watchable and something that you can sit back and enjoy. My main goal is to essentially translate what the director wants and put it into a format that an audience will really enjoy and understand. So I feel like on a very broad overview, that's what editing is. Editing is taking all of these disparate elements that are shot out of order and on different days and in various weather conditions and all kinds of different scenarios and assembling it in a way so that it looks like it was all just spooled out of the camera in perfect order.
When you're working, I imagine you're working with lots of different types of people when you're working with different directors, and I'm just wondering how that plays into the role that you have and the work that you do.
When I work with different directors, I find there are some that are really hands-on and some that are really hands-off and many in between. For me, the important thing is to make sure that the director's vision is really carried across. The director in the editing room is looking for an ally. He's looking for someone that will push back on certain things if you feel strongly enough about them, but really will help get their vision across. So when I worked on Margin Call and All Is Lost, I worked with J.C. Shandor.
This is Virginia Jean with an SOS call. Over.
He's a director I really like. I really like him as a person, and I really like him as a director. And most of the direction that I needed from him was in the writing. It was in the script, because the scripts were so articulated. They were so well written. So my process of working with JC was really, it was very laid back. I knew what he wanted just from some short conversations with him. He could explain what a character's arc was or what was important to him in a scene. And it was usually very easy to sort of get it where he wanted it to be. When I worked on Beasts of No Nation with Cary Fukunaga, I was in much more of a position of sort of interpreting what he wanted.
Aguya, I'm going to kill this man. Agu, these are the ones that killed your family. Eh? That killed your mother. These are the ones, the dogs that killed your father. That is your family's blood.
His style is all-encompassing. He shot the film himself. He wrote the script. And he directed the film, and he's incredibly close to the material, and he knows it better than anyone else. So when he was asking for specific things, it was really a matter of getting up to speed so that I could really help him find these things in the footage and find these like very subtle threads and weave them together in a way so that he was really satisfied.
It's really interesting to think about your point of view and seeing the footage through the lens of someone who hasn't written the script or directed the film and maybe not even been on set. And I was thinking about this when I was watching All Is Lost and thinking about speaking with you. And that's a film that has very little dialogue, and so much of understanding what's happening is in the visuals and the sounds that you're hearing and the music. And I just wonder, I thought that that might have been more challenging, but I don't know. Can you just talk about that?
Initially, when I read the script for All Is Lost, which was 30 pages, I was really terrified, because normally you can structure a scene quite easily based on dialogue. You know, most films are dialogue. Most films are just people talking. And so normally that gives you a framework that you can work within. All Is Lost, even though it was really well plotted, was incredibly loose. It was shot in a very documentary style. We had a lot of footage and we had a lot of options. And I sort of struggled with it for the first couple of weeks during production and didn't feel like I was getting it. I didn't feel like I was getting the footage or getting Robert's performance. And eventually I just realized that what the film was just pure visual storytelling. Normally I look at a section like a montage in a film that I'm cutting and I sort of hold off on it and I prefer to cut it last. When I look at a film like Margin Call or for a film like Beasts of No Nation, I want to focus on the dialogue. I want to focus on performance. And I want to get those scenes really humming along. And then I feel like, depending on the pacing that's happening within those dialogue scenes, it sort of informs the connective tissue that goes in between them. And a lot of times the montages are the connective tissue that goes in between them. And so my tendency is just to hold off on that stuff and cut it last, because I feel like I'll have like much more of the pacing and the structure together. So I was really resistant to working in this new way on All Is Lost. And so I'd sort of created some sound beds. I created the sound of waves, sound of winds and sails and rigging. And I just set up my iPhone, I ran it into the mixer, and I just listened to the sound that the character was going to be listening to all the time. And so I just let that run, and then I actually edited, I'd say 70% of the movie I edited silent, without any of our production audio playing. And I just treated this sort of background that was happening in the room as if this is his environment. And it really helped to put me into Robert's shoes, and it really helped me to figure out like what was important. And so now I long to do movies like that. It was put me so far out of my comfort zone, but in the best possible way.
Who determines how well you do as an editor? Would you say it's the director or the writer, or because it's their vision that you're putting out there on the screen?
Editing is one of those difficult things. When it's good, it's invisible. When it's bad, it's not necessarily the editor's fault. it's kind of a great job to have. If the movie's slow, a lot of times the director gets the blame. If the movie's humming along and it's awesome and it's really great, the director also gets the credit. So you're kind of this unseen set of hands behind the curtain. Ultimately, the director is the guy or the girl that you have to make happy. They are the people who brought you to their project. So ultimately, I want a director to be happy. I want to be happy. I want to be satisfied that I did a good job.
Help! Help!
That was film editor Pete Boudreau. His current work on Beasts of No Nation will be viewable at this year's Toronto Film Festival. So what does an editor do? What did we learn? That editing is about subtlety, relationships, suggestion, nurturing, being a little like a psychoanalyst, a little like being a parent who's not angry, they're just disappointed, being creative with your criticism, and perhaps above all, allowing the writer or director or actor or whoever it might be to keep their vision, but just to make sure the lens through which that vision is espied is clear as a bell. A stylish bell. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was the completely unedited Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.